Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and thanks for downloading our podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Well, it's been a bit since our last podcast, and the reason behind that is just basically the three of us have been really busy. Mike's currently in the heat of production right now, and it's really kind of cool because we're working on a show and we're involving what we're calling our special ops group over at FX PhD, which is a core group of members. There are a select few who are actually getting their feet wet in production, so we've got a lot of people around the world working with us, so it's been a lot of fun, and we'll be talking about more of that in the April term. Here in Chicago, I've been busy as well with FX PhD, of course, and doing production with the folks here at Hootenanny, and Jeff, as always, is just really busy working out in LA. But again, we've had a couple FX Guy TV apps out, and we'll be getting these out on a more regular basis here in the coming weeks, so thanks for your patience. So this week, I guess the best way to describe our podcast is by calling it a State of the Union regarding Eastman Kodak. Jeff Huser is going to be speaking with Gary Einhaus, who's the CTO and general manager of the digital cinema division there. And it's really quite interesting to hear what they've been up to. Actually, this week, Eastman Kodak has been in the news in maybe not so great way. The share price actually went down almost a third over the course of the week from where it started on Monday. Later in the week, a ratings company, Standard & Poor's, lowered its ratings on the company from B to B minus. It's basically putting them right in the middle from being below investment grade and being above default. So they're hitting that middle ground there. And of course, times have been really tough for Kodak as they're transitioning from their chemical film-based business into this digital world. But with that being said, film is still being used in a lot of TV commercials, a lot of feature films, obviously, episodic TV shows. I mean, sure, you've got stuff like the Red Camera and the Genesis and the Viper doing things, recording things digitally. But everyone ends up judging it by how things look on film. And Kodak isn't standing still regarding that. They've got a lot of really interesting developments in what they're doing to make their film stocks better and better, as well as some new forays into other areas. So without any further delay, why don't we go ahead and hear that from Gary. Jeff Huser speaking with Gary Einhaus.
I wanted to talk a bit about film. I mean, FX Guide obviously covers a lot of the digital technology in the industry, Red Cameras and Vipers and, the shiny stuff, as I say. We got to chase the latest shiny object. Mm-hmm. And the reason I came to talk to Kodak is I kind of was thinking one day that, I'm sure film is still the predominant acquisition and distribution medium. So I wanted to find out what was going on with Kodak and what's new with film. And
sure. Well, thanks. There is a lot of talk about digital, but we continue to innovate in our films, and we're very fortunate that film is still the choice for cinematographers, particularly for feature films. And so some of the developments, primarily the developments we've seen recently, have been in our Vision 3 stocks for camera negative film. And last year we introduced a new 500 speed tungsten film, which has met with a lot of success. The cinematographers that we work with really enjoy its benefits. So what we continually do in our film portfolio is invest in the fundamental ability of the silver halide crystals to capture light. And we try to continually make that more efficient. So what does that mean? Is that a given crystal can be able to gather more light to be more sensitive at a smaller size, that makes the performance of the film better. So we continue to improve that. And the next thing we need to do is, if once we make a more efficient crystal, we have to decide how to deploy that efficiency in a way that our customers benefit. And in this case, we are very closely linked with cinematographers. And in fact, when we were designing the Vision 3 500-speed film, before we decided what the aims were, we brought in a number of cinematographers. We brought in colorists from post-production houses. And we talked to them about film technology. And we talked about various ways that we could deploy this technology. What's more valuable to you? Is it more valuable to have higher speed? Is it more valuable to have lower grain? Is it more valuable to have higher latitude or more dynamic range? They gave us great feedback. And it's that feedback that taught us how to deploy our technology advances in ways that they would value. And what we really focused on in Vision 3 was extending dynamic range. I mean, film is already known as having exceptional dynamic range. And it is the, you know, the kind of the benchmark that others strive for. And it is, from my own experience in digital, one thing that is always challenging is how to design a sensor that has very high dynamic range. And so raising the bar, so to speak, on dynamic range, it not only, you know, does it, keep the competitive advantage of film, but it's also addressing needs that the cinematographers have. So basically what we did was we added about 3 stops of dynamic range. And we did that in 2 ways. One, we on the low exposure side and into the shadows, being able to reach deeper into the shadows, we improved the noise. Because dynamic range is all about signal-to-noise ratio. It's about the range of exposures over which you can maintain good signal-to-noise ratio. So by reducing the noise in the shadows, we were able to extend the dynamic range into the shadows. And we're finding that cinematographers are really taking advantage of that. It's not unusual for them to push the speed to reach deeper into the shadows. On the other end, on the highlight end, we added about 2 stops of exposure latitude.
Huh.
A little bit more than 2 stops of exposure latitude, so that you could, either record very high dynamic range scenes, the specular highlights in a high key scene, and not lose detail. The other reason that we focused on dynamic range is because of the new tools that are available in post-production, particularly in digital intermediate, where you can use power windows and you can reach into scenes and you can pull out the shadows and you can pull out those highlights. Well, they got to be there. You have to have information there, and having the information there so that you give more creative flexibility in post-production as well as in original. In original photography is really what we've built into these films.
That's great. Well, I noticed on the I was looking at the stocks on the website, and I was actually surprised how many new ones and how many that I was more familiar with have been retired or discontinued. The Vision 3, I noticed, is only the 500 right now. Is that the plan for everything to become Vision 3? Or
the plan is to deploy Vision 3 more broadly, and we're doing it based on usage. So our most popular film is 500 speed tungsten. It's the most used. So you'll start to see more deployments, in fact, very soon of this technology into the next most popular film and then the next most popular film.
Gotcha. Is the I noticed the 200, there was a lot of development a few years back on the 200, the blue screen stock, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more expensive and it was a little more, but it was a little finer grain or something. It was designed specifically for blue screen. And that didn't seem to be there. Is that because these other films have come further along, or?
It doesn't seem to be there in the sense.
I didn't see it in the list of stocks, did I?
The 200 speed tungsten film is still a part.
But it's not still. It's not a special designation anymore.
We haven't specially designated, but the features that were built into one film.
Oh, I see.
So the special effects needs were originally addressed in a special film, and then they said, "Well, it doesn't make sense. Let's put it in."
Oh, okay.
It serves everybody.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't hurt for non-special effects, but it helps for special effects. So those attributes are still exist in the 200 speed film.
And then in addition to the Vision 2 and Vision 3, I saw a couple of the Expression film stock.
Right. So this is addressing the desire of cinematographers to have more looks available to them. And Expression really is directed towards a lower contrast look.
Oh, okay. And then what about HD scan film, or color scan film, it's called?
Right. That's a film that we built, mostly for television. I mean, this is all changing rapidly,
yeah,
of course.
Sure.
At one point, all television productions would go through a telecine, so they would be scanned. They weren't useful unless they were scanned at some stage. So the idea was, well, why even bother with a film that needs to be optically printed, because television films never get optically printed. So we actually designed an even lower contrast film for telecine, and that's the HD stock.
Oh, okay. What about the other thing I'm reminded about just walking into this building, because when I first moved to LA, this was the CineSite building,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I wanted to take a minute to talk about some of the historical contribution that Kodak has made to the digital side that people don't think about. I mean, every frame of film that's scanned is generally filmed in the Cineon file format that was invented by Kodak, developed based on their scanning and recording technology.
Right, right.
So much of that early days, I mean, Kodak was really a pioneer in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like most pioneers, you know, the early days are the toughest days. But definitely, I would say that we were ahead of our time with Cineon, and we really did lay the foundation for the way things are done today in the industry, particularly around digital intermediate. I don't think that digital intermediate would be as far along as it is if Kodak had not pioneered the technologies in Cineon.
Sure, certainly. I would say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, I don't know, people that are maybe newer in the business might not know that perspective, but, I mean, Kodak really did push the technology very, very fast back then.
Certainly you're right. DPX files are the standard of the industry.
Absolutely. What about sensors? I know Kodak over the years has certainly stayed in the digital world, even more so with the sensor technology. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. We have an image sensor solutions business, actually a business in making and supplying sensors. Traditionally, that business has been focused on very high-end CCD-type sensors. And many of the professional cameras use sensors from Kodak, the Hasselblad camera, and there's others I won't be able to remember all of them. You know, the Mars rover has a Kodak CCD. We sent Kodak technology into NASA missions. And so the business was built originally around extremely high-quality CCD sensors for what I would consider professional and scientific applications. Our sensors are in many different kinds of scanners, linear array scanners, including you know, telecines like the Spirit as a Kodak sensor. We've since then evolved away from just being addressing. We still address the high end CCD, and are now starting to develop CMOS-based sensors for lower end applications, like the Motorola phone cam that recently came out as a Kodak sensor in it. So yeah, and we have recently released an HD sensor that's for HD video that looks like it's got some promise in the HD space.
Huh. Interesting. What about projection? It's something that me coming from the post side, we don't generally know much about. I mean, what's that technology like? I mean, obviously there's a lot of prints that have to be struck. There's a can you just kind of walk us through that process? And
so this is film projection.
Yeah, projection.
Sure. Of course, the industry has been built around, you know, creating an inner negative and some, you know, creating first an inner positive and then an inner negative that gets used over and over again to make lots of release prints so you can have these wide releases. And that is still predominantly the way films are made today, made and distributed.
And like thousands of prints of a film. For
yeah, it depends on the release patterns, but yeah, it can be, you know, to a few hundred to many thousands of prints are made and distributed depending on how widely the studio wishes to release the film. Very high-speed printers, the industry has become very efficient at making these prints. There's a couple of very dominant players who comprise most of the market. They've gotten very efficient through economies of scale. You know, they make a lot of prints and they distribute them to the theaters. The theaters project them, and that's how we see pictures today. Fortunately, mostly today, we enjoy the fact that most of those are on Kodak stocks.
Is there technology there that we aren't aware of? I mean, are there different film stocks in that realm as well?
Well, we do have two primary stocks. We have what we call a Vision stock and Vision Premier. Vision Premier is a specialty stock because it has extremely high dynamic range. And that's valuable to some of the productions. We find that particularly animation benefits from and enjoys the higher maximum density that's available with the Vision Premier stock. It's a little bit more expensive. It's not used, it's used less frequently, but it is a pretty striking when you have the ability to go to something like 10,000-to-1 contrast ratio.
Wow.
In the theater, in a darkened room.
So let's say a wide release like 3,600 theaters on an opening weekend, for example. Uh-huh. How long is a print like that valid? I mean, how long can a print like that last? Is that something has to replace then during the run?
It could. It depends on how long the run is, of course. Typically, we're looking at something like 200 screenings is not unusual. There's a maintenance issue, you got to make sure your gates are clean and the projector's well maintained. So there is a variable there in terms of how well the projectors are maintained. But typically, the number we hear is that you easily can get about 200 screenings out of a print. Prints are often, they're used in one theater and moved to another theater.
Hmm.
There's the concept of first run theaters and second run theaters. And
sure.
Sometimes they're shipped to other countries after they make their run in the U.S. It's not necessarily every movie is released simultaneously around the world.
Now, there's also limits of how many prints you can make from an Interneg and Interpause, right? Isn't there limits
to
that?
Yeah, and again, that varies. Again, each of the labs will, have, depending on how well they maintain their printers and how careful they are. But the number that generally people tell me is about 3,000 prints from one internegative.
Now, I've heard that some films have actually if it's an all digital and all DI color correction, they may strike multiple directly in the laser recording, for example, multiple masters. Is that something that we've seen?
That's true, absolutely. The multiple internegatives that are being struck in a laser recorder. It depends on the release patterns again. If it's a wide release, you're going to want to strike multiple internegs.
So that would save a generation film to film.
Right, there's no, you go directly to interneg.
So we'll probably see that expanding more and more.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you want to make sure that you have something that protects your original master. So at least one interneg that's created on the laser recorder is likely to be stored away.
Right.
As well as the digital version of that and
sure.
the digital file, and then make multiple copies to do printing.
Now, Kodak also does digital cinema projection. I was looking on the webpage, and I saw that there's a large division that does digital projection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I manage that business, so
oh, okay.
I can speak to that.
So that looks like, it's still numbers-wise growing. And 3D, I'm assuming, is pushing that somewhat just because the demand for 3D projection.
Well, if you ask somebody who's trying to manage a digital cinema business, it's growing very, very slowly.
Really?
The industry has come to somewhat of a standstill in deployment of digital cinema, and it's mostly it's very complicated, and it has very little to do with technology. It has all to do with the business model, and it has mostly to do with the credit situation, because in order for these the equipment is expensive, and in order for the equipment to be placed. There's a studio subsidy for it because the studios ultimately benefit, and they're willing to subsidize the purchase of the equipment for the exhibitor. But in order to raise the money, you need some bank to loan money, and as you probably know, loaning money has not been very, very free over the last, certainly over the last 6 months. But even the industry has really been in a stall for a year and a half.
Well, it has to be an expensive proposition. I mean, you buy a projector, I'm sure there's theaters out there running projectors for 20 years or more even.
Yeah, digital is definitely more expensive, and it probably won't last as long. I mean,
right.
It's the digital equipment, right? It won't last. Right. Even if it doesn't wear out, there's an issue of potential obsolescence that you have to worry about with any digital technologies. So, yeah, the proposition is more expensive, and the question is, where is the return?
Right.
And the return has clearly been demonstrated, at least so far, in 3D screenings. And any deployments that we've seen in the last year, although it's slowed, have largely been related to 3D and the drive for 3D. And the reason for that is because there's either no subsidy or less subsidy required by the exhibitor, because the exhibitor gets good payback from a 3D screen. And I think any momentum we're currently seeing in the market is in preparation for the slate of 3D films that we're expected to see in 2009 and beyond.
Right. So the studios save money by not having to make all the prints, but they still obviously have distribution costs. How is this distributed to the cinemas?
Well, today it's still mostly distributed by a hard drive being shipped via FedEx or via truck, although we are starting to see satellite distribution take hold. Satellite distribution, of course, is a multicast system, makes a lot of sense, but you need to have the scale of
Sure.
So we're starting to see, ultimately, everybody believes it'll be satellite distribution, but there's a startup piece where it's more efficient right now to send hard drives.
Right. But I see. From a satellite, you could hit multiple locations all at the same time.
All at the same time.
That's the beauty of it. Oh, that's interesting.
That's the beauty of it. But you need to have lots of dishes. And it doesn't, the first dish is very inefficient, right? If you're the only one receiving the satellite signal, you're going to pay a lot of money. But if you're one of many, many thousands, of course, it's a very efficient distribution system. So we're starting to see, and of course, satellite is the only way to do live.
Okay. So we're seeing a lot of that events too in that division.
We're starting to see live events. Certainly, they've experimented with NFL. The BCS championship game was broadcast to theaters. So, yeah, we're starting to see live. Live from the Met is quite popular, Metropolitan Opera.
Really?
So, there's some – this is what in the industry is called alternative content. And it's just beginning. But they believe another value of digital cinema is the ability to show what's called alternative content other than feature films. And for that, you need satellite. So satellite will eventually come, but right now, the short answer to your question is most of it is sent out on hard drives. Pretty
still
efficient.
Keep the FedEx stock. What about tools? I mean, I know I saw the digital ice technology. I was curious to talk about that a little bit for identifying and automating cleanup of scans.
Right. That's a technology that Kodak obtained in one of its acquisitions, and the digital ice technology actually was quite prevalent in your desktop film scanners for cleaning up negatives, dust, dirt, scratches, detecting, and then having the software to actually fill them in and clean them up. And when we acquired that technology, we learned to apply the technology to motion imaging.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Yeah.
And we've been very, very pleased with we've partnered with Arri. We've also partnered with Laser Graphics to incorporate our technology into their scanners. And the customer reaction has been very positive. It's a very labor-intensive task to do dust busting. And we're not claiming we get everything. But getting 80 to 90% of the problems and then being able to identify problems that we can't correct but show the post house where the problems are, and they can go in and just correct the ones that we can't correct or are uncertain about.
Can we talk a little bit about the technology of that? How's this work?
Actually, it's pretty interesting. The technology is based on using infrared, and basically what you're trying to do, as you're saying, is that any imperfections in that you don't want to be there are going to show up in the infrared, but they're not going to and you'll know because the dyes that create the image are not absorbing infrared. By difference, you can tell what is meant to be there and what's not meant to be there. And so we use an infrared scan, and then we have to do a lot of software to try to make sure that what we're getting is real and not spurious. And we also have to make sure that we're cleanly separating out the image from the infrared that is from a scratch that is clearly the piece that's a scratch and not image content.
Sure.
That's kind of where the magic is.
Yeah, well, that's when you said taking it to moving pictures from stills. I mean, I know I've talked to many developers over the years about applying techniques from still images that look fantastic to
It's a much more difficult challenge to apply it to moving images, although I will tell you that there's some advantages to moving images because you can use the correlation frame to frame to give you some indication about how to correct.
It's funny how we get tuned to dust and dirt and things. I was recently working on a job, and I went to dust bust a scene, and I went, wait, this was shot digitally. It was actually a reflection in this car bumper, but it just popped. It was this little white ping that just, So, I mean, fooling software would be very...
You got to be careful that you don't get fooled.
Yeah.
So we've been very we've been very pleased with the customer response to that technology.
So if the software can't fix it, then it produces a defect map, I assume?
Yes, it produces a defect map. And it shows you that, we found the defect, we've corrected it, and we're confident. We found a defect, we're not confident enough to correct it, but we tell you that it's there. And then you have the in-between where we've corrected it, but you may want to check just to be sure. Which is, from what we hear from our customers, is a great tool to reduce a lot of labor.
That's great. There's also something I was curious about on the website called Look Management System.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
So that was a product that we put together to allow cinematographers to take a picture on a set and then to be able to take that digital image and show them what it would look like if you were to choose different stocks or if you were to choose certain kinds of processing effects like skip bleach or push processing, pull processing. So it was really meant to be a tool for the cinematographer on the set to be able to visualize if they were able to choose different options, either stock or processing options, what it would look like before they actually shot it.
Oh, like in a pre-pro type environment, or researcher, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a pre-visualization tool, except it was meant to be used on the production set when you actually are there at the spot where you're taking the pictures. It's not enjoyed a lot of success, and the reason, even though the cinematographers like the idea, I think what we found is that when they're on the set, there's so many pressing issues that it's difficult to actually, you know, take the time to, you know, to do all this work to pre-visualize. We've had some success. Some cinematographers have really enjoyed it and have used it, but I wouldn't say it's been widespread. Where we have found it's been very interesting is in the education market for people who are learning cinematography to actually see what all these things do.
Interesting.
All these different stocks, and you talked about expression. What would it look like on expression? What would it look like on these other stocks? What does it mean to bypass the bleach or to push and pull process? And cross process, all these things that the funky things people do to create looks, to help students understand why the expert, you know, seasoned cinematographers use it and what look they're trying to produce. So we found that there's been more, you know, interest there than where we originally had planned for it.
Yeah, somebody mentioned to me, I was talking to somebody about doing this podcast, and they said it's interesting that they've seen, it seems like all the DOPs are moving toward digital stuff and starting to touch the, you know, either into it or get into it or experimenting with it. Meanwhile, all the students are like, they've been shooting digital and they want to shoot film.
Absolutely. I mean, you really made it when you get to shoot 35 millimeter. That's when you've really graduated.
Right.
But it still is, you're right, it still is the standard of our industry. Although digital, you know, like I said, Kodak is in the digital business.
Right.
And so we know digital and we know film and we know digital technologies continue to make progress. And they do continue to make progress. We're still investing in film, so we're continuing to raise the bar. And, you know, in all these things, it's not about, you know, what's better or worse. It's what do you need for your application.
Right. Right. Pick the right tool.
Pick the right tool for your application. And, you know, we think that, you know, for many cases it'll be film. In other cases, a certain digital technology may perfectly meet the need.
Right. And Kodak's in both.
And we're in both. That's right.
Well, that's great.
Well, fascinating discussion. Thanks, Gary, for taking the time to sit down with Jeff and have a chat. Really interesting to hear behind the scenes, actually some of the changes in the motion picture stock as well as the digital impact and so forth. So, again, I found the conversation really fascinating. One interesting fact that I didn't bring up at the open of the podcast I thought was interesting was a status about how many jobs Eastman Kodak has or positions, employees they have. Now, they're cutting between 3,500 and 4,500 jobs over the course of this year, 14% of their workforce approximately. And, you know, obviously right now in the current financial conditions that's happening with a lot of companies. But they're going to actually target an employment rate that's around 20,000 people employed in the whole company. And that's from a peak of 145,000 people in 1988. So that's incredibly significant if you think about that, from almost 150 down to 20,000 in about 20 years. And again, that just really shows, even though Kodak's very active in doing digital cameras and printing, and trying to really change their business model, obviously not having all these consumers having point-and-shoot cameras, people using digital, has had such a tremendous impact on their business. And obviously the entertainment business is also now having an impact on that. Well, that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And we're going to, as I said at the introduction, we're going to have more coming out on a more regular basis and get these back in the flow. Keeping our heads above water. But again, we appreciate your patience while we've been, you know, having our lives, I guess. So anyway, as always, for my partners, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.